Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Did you ever look at yourself as playing an important role in our collective history? Well, today we're going to explain why your story is our story, and we're going to introduce you to the organization that's going to help you tell it. Then we're going to host an eye-opening conversation that'll help frame exactly what we're facing here in Connecticut when it comes to child trafficking and what you can do about it. And we're going to also celebrate half a century of open government and the many ways our state's Freedom of Information Act helps make that happen as it turns 50 years old in 2025. But first, we want to tell you about the free Campus Connect Speaker Series, which engages Fairfield University's on-campus and off-campus communities in topical conversations hosted by a variety of local and university experts. Monthly events are held in the second-story event space at the downtown Fairfield University store. Coming up January 30th at 5 p.m., check out an interactive panel discussion considering the behavioral, mental health, educational, and local policy perspectives of cell phone use among youths in today's landscape. For more information about this upcoming Campus Connect Speaker Series and other free community events at the Fairfield University store, just go to events.fairfield.edu. Well, as we mentioned in the introduction, yes, we want to hear your story, according to the website for History Chip, which is historychip.com. The history of the rich and powerful, the 1%, has its place, but only if it sits alongside the rest of the world's history. And History Chip began back in 2009 as an effort to include the stories of the other 99% previously left out of history. We've got a lot to talk about with the founder of History Chip. I'm so pleased to welcome Gene McGavin to the program. Gene, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So let's roll it back way before 2009. Was your first few experiences getting interested in history formed around kind of the holiday table with relatives talking about your own family and maybe unearthing some discoveries about some of the people that you love or were related to?
I suppose, you know, I grew up in Virginia, and Virginia is steeped in history. And I always was quite fascinated by my own history, my own family's history, which went way back in Virginia and way back in Pennsylvania as well. But I think what really crystallized my interest that then took me to History Chip was my fourth grade history textbook taught us that slaves were happy on the plantations and that they were so much better off there on plantations as slaves than they would have been in Africa with their families and what life they knew. When you're taught history in grade school, at least when I was taught history in grade school, and this was granted at the tail end of Jim Crow, history is sort of handed down on like stone tablets, and it's not, you know, from the gods. It's not supposed to be. We don't argue with it. It's what we're taught. It's what we are told to believe. And but then getting a little older, realizing that wait, slaves couldn't have been happy. And then realizing that our history was actually a lie, and our history textbook was a piece of propaganda written by people with a very specific point of view, a very Jim Crow point of view, that then indoctrinated an entire generation of children with a racist idea. And the realization that takes generations to undo, and And so the importance of including everybody's voices in history can make a huge difference in people's lives going forward. Had they included the lives of the voices of slaves, the understanding of what it must have felt like to be a slave on a plantation, to be sold, to have your family separated from you, that would have been a completely different education than what I was given in grade school. And then when I was in eighth grade, we were given a history lesson where we were asked to read a couple of dozen versions of the first-person accounts of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And each of those was slightly different, who fired the first shot, et cetera. And so all of us little eighth-grade historians were asked to then extrapolate from all this information what happened at that battle. And so that taught me, that lots of voices are necessary to come to the truth of an event or in history. So that those two lessons, that history can't be true if it excludes crucial voices, and two, that multiple stories add clarity and truth to history. So those were foundational, as much as my interest in my own family's history. Those ideas became foundational to then starting History Chip later on down the road.
And certainly when we look at the books of our childhood and our young years in school with many of the selective views and the compartmental inaccuracies, and then we experience what you experienced, that sort of epiphanous moment later in life when we started to look back and realize, maybe Santa Claus wasn't the Santa Claus that we were brought up to think of. So certainly the technology and the accessibility to it has also played a massive role in you being able to make the heavy lift that History Chip has been doing and continues to endeavor to do. Let's talk about the piecing together of what has now become this product and this website and this effort that launched back in 2009.
Well, right. So in 2009, we did launch. It was under the title of Story Chip at the time. In 2019, I changed it to History Chip. Mm-hmm. But so it was a rather rudimentary website. But even then, pre-internet, this kind of a project just wouldn't have been possible. And that's in part why history has been told by the rich and famous, because they were the ones who could write and they were the ones who could read and they were the ones who were telling the story. But now with the internet, where everybody's got a phone in their hand, they can go onto our website and add a story. They can also add their story on social media. But at History Chip, their story then goes into a permanent archive. It goes into history. It's not just thrown away with, people's pictures of people's lunch. We have built this platform that is fully searchable. You can take a video of anything that's going on in your world and upload it onto the website, and you've got a piece of history that you've contributed to the story of our world. And yes, that we couldn't do that. We have had growing pains. We've added technological advances every year to History Chip, and we're continuing to do that every day as we continue to make this easier for people to tell their story. We want to eliminate any barriers to telling your story and to being able to say, "This is me. I'm here. This has been my experience in this world. This is what it's like." to be me, no matter what my station in life, no matter what my color, my abilities, my physical abilities, my whether I'm in jail, whether I'm a drug addict, whether I am a paraplegic, whether I am an immigrant, whether I'm a doctor, or a lawyer, or an Indian chief, all of us can go onto this website and become a part of history.
It's certainly a remarkable effort, and I have to say, I hope that you're achieving the goals that you have set for History Chip in regards to greatly broadening the diversity of these stories being told. I have to say, as a journalist and an interviewer and someone who has worked at times over the years trying to help give voice or at least help marginalized individuals advocate a little bit more for themselves or tell their own stories when they're facing times of challenge. It is frustrating sometimes because these marginalized individuals don't feel that their story is important. Some may feel they really don't even have a story, and that's got to be the saddest thing of all.
Exactly. And we know that every single person has a story. On this past weekend, January 11th, mm-hmm. we had a mini rave in New London. And I was talking to one gentleman there in advance of that event and telling him he should come on Saturday and tell his stories. And he said, "Oh, no, I don't have any stories. I grew up in Brooklyn. I don't have any story. You don't want to hear the stories that I have to tell." And over the course of an hour, after him protesting that he didn't have any stories, he told me probably 20 stories, and all really representative of what life is like through his experience. And many of these were heartbreaking stories. Many of these were really profound stories that we should all know about. That we should all know about what life is like for certain segments of the population, what life is like, because how do we make public policy? How do we care for people who are struggling, who have had difficult circumstances? How do we know if they don't stand up and say, "This is what my life has been like, and this is what I need, this is what would have made my life better"? And if we're telling the story of the fires in LA, we're not going to be talking about the mayor or the Hollywood starlets. We're going to be focusing on what it's like to lose a home, what it's like to be a firefighter. That's the history of these fires. It's not about the rich and famous people. It's not about the big important people in California. It's about the individual people's lives. That's the history of this fire.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say that one of the most heart-wrenching stories that I had been hearing reporting on are the tens of thousands of service workers and others who take care of these properties that are now leveled and scorched. That suddenly, virtually overnight, 10,000 people, for lack of a better term, went out of business, irrelevant of where these people came from, who they are, how much they have or how little they have, race, creed, what have you. All of a sudden, the pool cleaners and the landscapers and the house keepers and such. Those who do the driving or other chores and activities, the switch flipped off overnight. And this is the kind of thing that you want to hear about. So you have a statewide project that you are going to be doing on April 5th. It's called the All Connecticut Storytelling Rave.
Yes.
This sounds like one of those things where you're casting a very wide and deep net with the hopes of really fortifying your stock of history stories on historychip.com. Let's move toward the end of our chat and talk a little bit more about that, what you hope to gain through it, and how folks can come to it or participate.
Yes, we're really excited about this. So April 5th, All Connecticut Storytelling Rave. We'll be reaching out to every library, every historical society, every town hall, museum, senior center, community center, brew pubs, and coffee shops to act as hosts for storytelling. We want people all over the state on the 5th of April. And they can also go on the site before or after and add stories. But we're really focusing on this one day to galvanize interest and storytelling. We're looking to get 10,000 stories on that day from all over the state of Connecticut, from farmers to taxi drivers to the governor, to come and tell their stories.
It's very rare. It's so rare when something happens that every single person can do.
Right. And the only thing that I can think of is when we vote. The voting is today, where everybody goes. I think that's also, this is more of a celebration, so I'm hoping that people will take this in the same way as voting. I'm standing up for myself, but I'm going to go do this. It's going to be fun. I can talk about myself. I can share my point of view, my experience, and you'll get a sticker or a button or a thank you. Everyone will get some thank you for having added their story.
Yeah.
And because we want we are looking to build enormous momentum with this as well, to get everyone all over the state to know about History Chip, so that even after the rave, people will know this is a place where they can tell their story, and it will be preserved forever, and it's fully searchable. It will be part of history. Their story will matter. Their story will be a part of a permanent archive that will help to shape the future, help to ennoble ordinary people, to help to build empathy and understanding for the full range of people in Connecticut and in the world itself.
Now, while correlating to voting in terms of it's something everybody can do, certainly History Chip and the All Connecticut Storytelling Rave on April 5th, or any storytelling that's done through the History Chip initiative, it's not restricted to 18 and older. Young people bring a spectacular energy, obviously, and sometimes maybe the most poignant stories of all in the shortest of lives by comparison to some centenarians or other older folks who have come to History Chip with a much bigger history book, if you will.
Right, that's true. The stories of kids going through school and COVID or watching their friends struggle with depression or
sure.
drug addiction, or even just what it's like to be bullied or just to, you know, I hate math. I don't want to do this.
Right.
And we do invite everyone to tell their stories. We do request that children under 16 have permission from their parents. Mm-hmm. And they can, you can go on History Chip and post your story anonymously because we do want to protect children. Mm-hmm. We don't want their names and information out there.
Sure.
So we do take pains to make sure that they are protected.
Excellent. Well, I so appreciate the conversation with you and the opportunity to chat. Gene McGavin is founder of History Chip, the All Connecticut Storytelling Rave, is hoping to gather 10,000 new stories within the day of April 5th. We hope you'll go to historychip.com to learn more about how to be part of our collective history. Thank you so much, Gene, for the conversation this morning, and best of luck on the 5th. And I think we're going to be talking to you again. So I look forward to that. So are you one of those people that think that child trafficking is not the kind of thing that's happening in Connecticut? Well, we've got a very important guest this morning on the award-winning For the People from a organization called Love 146, whose goal is to end child trafficking and exploitation. They journey alongside children impacted by trafficking today and work to prevent the trafficking of children tomorrow. We're going to get into that conversation right now, but we do want to remind you that, we're starting to move into the new year here, and maybe you're planning on moving, or maybe you're just decluttering. Well, we want you to tap Wilton Go Green's Fairfield County Donation Guide as a possible resource highlighting local donation sites for Fairfield County residents and businesses. The goal of this project is to repurpose special gently used items that might feel a little too valuable to just toss away, like tools or furniture and accessories, crochet blankets, children's books, sports equipment, pet supplies, even medical equipment, and more. Find the next forever home for all your no longer needed stuff by visiting wiltongogreen.org/Fairfield-County-Donation-Guide, or just go to wiltongogreen.org and find the Fairfield County Donation Guide on that site. Well, we are welcoming Erin Williamson to the program. She's the Chief Programs and Strategy Officer for Love 146. Erin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have to have a really important adult conversation just because every time I'm with two or more people and somehow the subject of child trafficking comes up, at least one or more of the other people kind of look down and say, I don't think that's a big problem around here. But you and your organization, in fact, would not exist if it wasn't an issue here in Connecticut and beyond, of course. Let's talk a little bit about you and how you were inspired to come to this organization to help them carry out this critical mission.
It surprisingly does exist in every state and in every community, and I know we're going to get into that. I was originally hired by Love 146 to build what is now our survivor care program in Connecticut. My background is in social work and public administration. I have been doing child sexual exploitation throughout my entire career, and I moved here from Washington, D.C., and so it just, the alignment of Love 146 looking to build this program the same year that I moved here just seemed very, almost like it was meant to be. We started the program with one person, and now we have over 20 staff members.
So let's talk a little bit more about the formation of the organization. Let's go back to that one person shop. When did this whole thing get started? And and how were you able to grow so quickly into this great team that you have now?
Yeah, yeah. So Love 146 started back in 2002. It actually started internationally, like many of the people who are listening today and many of the people that you were just referencing. I think a lot of people thought trafficking was something that happened over there, right, in other countries. And our founders really, started the work internationally and supporting programs internationally. But a lot of, as they kind of delved into this and as they learned more, they realized and were sharing with our supporters that, you know, trafficking does happen here in the United States. And it was actually a lot of our supporters that really challenged us to think, okay, this is great that we're helping individuals overseas, but what are we doing here for the children who are being victimized right here in our own community? And that was when they hired me in 2014. I think I started on January 4th, and by January 18th, we were already working with our first youth. And the truth is that we started getting referrals really, really quickly. And again, to your point, it was just, we are a statewide program. So I was running all over the state, meeting with as many children as I could to share information with them, to engage in safety planning with them, to really try to connect them to services and supports. And what really became apparent was that we lacked services and supports for this population, right? I could get them in with a therapist, but that therapist wasn't familiar with human trafficking. I could maybe get them into a mentorship program, but that really wasn't, they weren't specialized to deal with the significant trauma that these youth have experienced. And so we really realized that we needed to build out our own specialized services to work with this population. And that's what we've done. And frankly, year over year, the demand for services, as more and more people hear about us and more people are being trained and recognizing human trafficking in their own communities, the demand continues to outpace our capacity. So at this point, we serve about 150 youth every year. We serve kids in every county in Connecticut. So if any of your listeners are thinking, oh, that only happens in big cities, or that doesn't happen in my community, I can tell you with certainty that unfortunately it does, and we serve kids in your community. Our social workers drive all around the state, really working closely and with not just their children, but their families. It might surprise people to know that, most of our children are living at home when they're first referred to us. Most of our children, their legal guardian is their parent or another family member. And so we know that it's important not just to support the children with services, but also the parents. Mm-hmm. And, you said, how did you grow so fast? I wish we could double our programs, because unfortunately we have a wait list right now of about 30 kids. It's been both successful, but it's also uncovered a lot of what is happening in the state.
Yeah. Well, it's challenging, I'm sure, to work the words child trafficking into the brand of a nonprofit. Where did Love 146 come from?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a great question. So when our founders, again, went overseas to figure out how do we support what is happening and how do we help children, they did something that we now wouldn't recommend anybody doing, but this was back in the early 2000s when very little was known about this crime and victimization. They actually went undercover with another organization into a brothel. And what they saw were very, very young children, all dressed in red dresses, all with numbers pinned to those dresses. And there was a one-way mirror where the customers in this brothel and bar could see the girls, but the girls could not see the customers that were there to purchase them. And the men were handed menus, and on those menus were numbers associated with the girls that were pinned, the numbers that were pinned onto the girls, and prices for various sexual acts. And, you know, many of the girls were kind of, there was a TV in the room that they were sitting in. Many of them were staring at the TV with fairly, you know, blank faces or blank expressions. Mm-hmm. But there was one girl, her number was 146, and she was looking out through the mirror. And, you know, I think there was a sense or a hope that maybe she was looking at, out with some fight, but we actually, we don't know what she was thinking. But that girl really stuck with our founders. And unfortunately, a couple of weeks later, when that brothel was raided, somebody had tipped them off. And so the police were unable to rescue these girls. And so they chose to name the organization after that girl because they wanted to, us to always remember and be reminded that while we talk about this issue broadly, oftentimes it is about these individual children who experience this deep form of victimization and trauma. And it is the children who we center in our work.
Mm. Well, how do you see this issue right now on the front lines in Connecticut? How big a problem is it?
Yeah, so we started in 2014, and we've almost served our 1,000th child. Like I said, we serve about 150 kids annually. Our services are really meant for children who are 12 and older. Although I will say we have gotten referrals for significantly younger children, and we do our best to help them when we can or support the families. You know, some of the children are groomed and recruited and exploited by individuals that they know, right? These are individuals perhaps in their neighborhood or who they met in a mall or but others are recruited and exploited by individuals they're meeting online. So we have seen kind of a dramatic shift in really needing to engage in online safety with a lot of children and, again, their parents. I think the internet's moving very fast. Apps are changing exceptionally quickly. Privacy settings are not set in a default mode that protects children. So we're definitely seeing kind of an increased need for education around internet safety that just is not happening in our schools, unfortunately, I think, in the way that it needs to be happening. But we're also seeing, you know, vulnerabilities that traffickers are taking advantage of, right? Poverty, lack of parental involvement. These are anytime there's a trafficker, they're going to identify a vulnerability that they can exploit. And, you know, with COVID, unfortunately, what we saw was that these vulnerabilities were significantly exacerbated. So, you know, we're now seeing more children with food insecurities, with housing insecurities. We're seeing a number of children with significant mental health needs, which makes them vulnerable to predators. And then also exacerbates the trauma that they experience. And you know, our mental health system is really being, it's beyond capacity mm-hmm. to serve all of the children at this point.
Yeah. Well, in the remaining 5 minutes or so that we have with you, Aaron, tell us what parents and caregivers can do and our listeners who may not be parents or caregivers, there's a job for everybody to do to begin to stem the incidence of child trafficking here in Connecticut and beyond.
There is. And so, you know, I'm going to first talk for parents and caregivers and, like you said, other adults, what they can do to help protect children in their own lives. Actually, if you go website love146.org, on the top there's a banner that's highlighted, and if it talks about parent resources, if you sign up for that, it's an email series where we give really practical advice about how parents and caregivers and aunts and uncles and older brothers and sisters and really anyone can engage in important safety conversations with their children to help them understand and protect them on the internet and from potential predators. The other thing is, you know, we're a community here, and I really want to your listeners to know that a lot of the support that we receive as an organization and that our children receive is funded through our community, through, you know, our average donation is $25. That makes a difference. Of course, we get some grant funding, we get some state and local government funding, but there are huge gaps in our funding structure for us to meet the emergency needs of children, for us to help celebrate their successes. That's where, you know, the people who are listening here today, that's where you can really help us and help these children. So like you said, there is a role for everybody to play. This has to be a movement if we're going to really eradicate the trafficking of children and youth in our state.
Well, you've served over 1,000 in just a little over a decade, and 30 right now as we speak on the waiting list for your assistance. So certainly, as you mentioned earlier, it would be great for Love 146 to be able to grow their staff and resources to be able to keep that waiting list down to zero, and to certainly address the much higher proportional number of child victims who are not receiving the support that they need. As we wrap up the conversation, just remind people of several of the most impactive outcomes that these children have to deal with into adulthood as a result of their being trafficked.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of our children have been experienced significant mental health, right? And even if you deal with the immediate trauma, right, that comes up when you're getting married, when you're thinking of having your own children, when you're raising your children and you're realizing, oh my gosh, my child is now the age I was when I was first exploited. And so those mental health needs, you know, they ebb and flow throughout a person's life. Some of our children have experienced some significant physical violence, and that physical violence can have long-term and even permanent repercussions on them. You know, I think when we also think of the financial consequences, many of our children are missing or dropping out of school. And so we focus heavily on school re-engagement because we know that financial independence is really a huge protective factor. However, you know, that educational loss has real financial implications if we're not able to get those kids into jobs, into career paths, to help them find a way and see a way forward where they can economically sustain themselves and their families going forward. So yeah, there's kind of that immediate trauma, but I also really appreciate you recognizing the long-term trauma, the long-term implications for this form of victimization into adulthood.
I appreciate that. Erin Williamson is Chief Programs and Strategy Officer for Love 146. Their singular goal, put child trafficking out of business here in Connecticut and beyond. We hope you'll get to know this organization, learn more, and share that information with all of your friends. Anyone you know who has a child needs to know what Love 146 can offer you as some of their resources at their website, love146.org. Erin, thank you so much for your time this morning, and we'll talk to you again. Well, as a journalist, I have filed and been successful in freedom of information requests and appeals through the Connecticut Freedom of Information Commission and under the Connecticut Freedom of Information Act. I've also more recently been subject to a Freedom of Information inquiry in another job that I have. So I've seen both sides of this business that is celebrating 50 years members of the Connecticut Freedom of Information Act here in 2025. And we're going to talk about this groundbreaking and critically important open government initiative with Russell Blair. He is the Director of Education and Communications for the Freedom of Information Commission up in Hartford. We want to get into that conversation, but first, we want to make sure you're going to let the good times roll and celebrate Mardi Gras in style. We want you to be part of the solution to reduce youth and gun violence. Advocate for healthier communities by joining Catalyst CT for a night of unforgettable fun, food, and festivities, all for this great cause. You can get your tickets for the Bayou Bash, Mardi Gras for a Mission, and experience an evening where music and purpose unite to celebrate lasting change. You can dance the night away with Christine Ullman and the Funky Dogs Brass Band. Your tickets also include 3 hours of live music, delicious appetizers, and an open bar. You can learn more and reserve your tickets now by going to catalystct.org/events. Sounds like fun, Russell.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it'll be a good time.
That's right. I wonder if they're going to have crawfish on the as one of those heavy apps. We'll find out. So you're relatively new to the position, Russell. We have been blessed to have your predecessor, Tom Hennick, on the program. I have worked with him in many capacities over the many years. It's fantastic for you to have stepped into this position. I've already been able to experience some training from your style and perspective, and appreciate your work.
No, thanks for that, John. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, maybe it's serendipity, but Tom and I have a similar background in that we both worked in journalism before we did this. And I know you worked in journalism, too. So, you know, that's the perspective I try to bring to this is really, you know, freedom of information. You know, it's about connecting people with information. And that was what I did for a number of years as a journalist. So, you know, here at the commission, you know, my job is really to provide education about the law, to explain, you know, to both people, you know, how they can make an FOI request and also to try to explain to cities and towns, you know, how to handle it on the other end. You know, what information can they disclose? What information is exempt? You know, I find that, you know, at least in my experience, you know, a lot of times it's not that people, you know, don't want to give out information. They have a lot of questions about what can be disclosed and how to do it the right way. And most of the people that do this work in cities and towns are not attorneys. And you don't have to be an attorney, you know, to know about FOI. But sometimes, you know, it's helpful to have an education session and learn, you know, what to do and what not to do.
Sure. Well, in a litigious society, it's no wonder public officials, whether they be paid, appointed, volunteers, they're very sensitive to the information that they may be able to purvey to members of the public. So the education from the Freedom of Information Commission here in Connecticut is critically important, and I hope we'll be able to convey a little bit of that over the next 10 or 12 minutes. As a journalist, were you working here in Connecticut?
Yes. So I've actually lived in Connecticut my whole life. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the town of Chester, down, you know, Middlesex County, down mm-hmm. along the Connecticut River. I went to UConn. I studied journalism and political science. And my first job, I was a reporter at the Record Journal in Meriden, mm-hmm. Covering the town of Wallingford. Went to many a public meeting, many a late night at a town council or a school board. And then I transitioned over to the Hartford Current. And there, I did a lot of different things. You know, was on the web team for a little while. Did some reporting, you know, did some editing, and, you know, just sort of toward the end, by way of attrition, you know, I kind of kept getting more and more responsibilities, you know, but it was really interesting, you know, and I think it was helpful to sort of see, you know, public meetings and FOI requests, you know, from that end of things. And, you know, I often speak about my experience as a reporter, you know, when I'm out there doing trainings to try to help make it make sense for people.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time you either had to use or called upon Connecticut's freedom of information laws to get your job done?
You know, I probably don't remember the first time, but I know very frequently early on as a reporter, I was covering a lot of police, you know, issues. And, and so very frequently I would be requesting, you know, reports, you know, from the, you know, from the police department. And, you know, I was lucky in that, you know, I was a young reporter, but, you know, I developed a good relationship with the lieutenant, you know, who oversaw the records division, you know, and they understood what my job was. You know, I understood their job and sometimes why they might have been reluctant to release, you know, certain things. But, you know, I think it was helpful, you know, and we developed a good, you know, a good relationship. And, you know, I think that that helped the FOI process sometimes to be a little bit, you know, more smoothly, you know, just because we understood kind of where we stood and we understood our different jobs and our responsibilities. And, you know, you learn as you go and you understand sometimes, you know, it could be frustrating maybe when you can't get a certain record, but you learn about the different exemptions and you can understand, you know, maybe you're unhappy, but you could say, all right, I understand why I can't get this particular piece of information, you know, right now.
Well, let's look back this half century to the term of Ella Grasso when this whole FOI thing started here in Connecticut.
I mean, so the FOI law has, you know, it's been the law for 50 years. As you mentioned, Ella Grasso was the real champion of the Freedom of Information Act in Connecticut. It passed in 1975. So we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary this year. You know, interesting little, you know, factoid, it actually passed the State House representatives and the State Senate unanimously. And, you know, I've talked to some people who were around at the time. And, you know, what I've been told is, you know, maybe people were afraid to vote against it. You know, they didn't want to be on the record as voting against, you know, an open government law. So, you know, it had bipartisan support there, you know, and if you think about it, it was really kind of a radical idea that, you know, we didn't have a law in place there. Well, there was some sort of, you know, open records law, but, you know, didn't really have a mechanism that, you know, for enforcement. So, you know, one of the strongest things the FOI law did is, you know, it did put in place, you know, more of a structure for all of this. You know, it required open meetings, it required access to records, but it also created a commission where citizens can go if they feel that their town is not doing things correctly, if they're not providing them with records, if there's issues with a public meeting. It gives a really effective tool for citizens to come and make a complaint. And we have attorneys that'll figure out what happened and try to get to the bottom of it. And if we find that a town is not following the FOI law, you know, we have enforcement tools. We can issue fines, we can order trainings, you know, we can order disclosure of records. So it's not just that we have this open records law, we also really have a pretty unique commission. You know, not every state has an FOI commission there to make sure people are doing the right thing.
Well, flashing to this very day and the Connecticut General Assembly, as we talked about for a moment or two before we went on the air this morning, there's some housekeeping issues having to do with the Freedom of Information Act that are on the agenda, but also kind of a fundamental change that is helping to bring the collection of information by the public in city halls into the 21st century, finally, in terms of expanding how they can copy or assimilate documents of certain qualified documents, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I, in terms of, you know, when you were talking earlier about, you know, legislation, you know, the commission has proposed this year, you know, some technical changes to the FOI Act, you know, to kind of modernize a few things. You know, there's a definition in there about a handheld scanner, and today people are not walking around with handheld scanners in their pockets, but they might have a cell phone, so we're trying to modernize that. You know, but I'll be quite frank, a lot of times, you know, I think we feel like we're more often on defense in terms of the FOI law. You know, every year there's proposals for new exemptions and new exceptions, and, you know, we look at those very carefully. You know, Connecticut has a really strong FOI law, and you know, we want to keep that in place. You know, certainly there's, you know, new issues that arise every day. You know, one of the big ones that's come up recently is body camera footage. So, you know, all the footage captured on a body-worn camera of a police officer, those are all public videos. But, you know, there's a debate ongoing about, you know, what should be disclosed and what shouldn't be disclosed. And you know, trying to find the balance there for transparency in law enforcement, but also, you know, protections for minors and protections for victims and witnesses and so on.
Well, I think if we were to make one super pertinent point in this entire conversation, Russell, it would be that very little of what taxpayers pay for is not available to them under this law. There's a comparatively fractional number of things that people can't look at or aren't entitled to look at as Connecticut citizens. And apparently in the 50 years that this act has been around, it's been doing a great job.
Yeah, the presumption under the FOI Act is disclosure. The presumption, of the law is that if it's a record dealing with public business, then the public has the opportunity to request a copy or to request to inspect that record. And really, exemptions should be narrow. And I think people would be surprised. I agree with you. I think people would be surprised to learn just how much information, is available to them. If you want to get information about, town expenditures, all the invoices, all the bills, all those are going to be public, communications and correspondence among, town employees and even among elected officials, text messages, emails, correspondence is widely available under the FOI Act. It's really, a minority of records, oftentimes maybe dealing with particular legal issues or, with law enforcement records. We talked about body camera, but also police reports. There's certain information that they're allowed to redact. But, by and large, if you're interested in what's going on, in your city or town, you can file a FOIA request. And I think you'd be surprised at just how much information is available to you.
Mm. And part of your job is going around to these cities and towns, if not to school or reschool new incoming or reoccurring public officials and elected officials. You also show up at other places to do public talks to help people learn more about Connecticut FOI. At this point, is there anything on the agenda in terms of celebratory activities over this 50-year anniversary?
It's the start of the year. We're looking into planning some events for later in the year. The commission already partnered with the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information, and we had a briefing for legislators on January 13th at the state capitol. I imagine our annual conference, which we hold every fall, is going to touch on in some way the 50th anniversary. I also imagine some of our partners, I mentioned the CCFOI, also the Connecticut Foundation for Open Government, will likely be joining them on some events. And we do really want to celebrate the 50 years of this law. And I also think it's important that the law has remained strong. Yes, as I mentioned earlier, there's always efforts to chip away at aspects of it, but the general premise of the law as it was written in 1975 is still in effect today, 50 years later.
And has served as a template for a number of other municipalities, counties, states over the years. Many have borrowed from it quite effectively.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, even other countries, we've actually had delegations from other countries. I know one, a couple that were mentioned recently, Mexico, Liberia, officials from those countries have come to Connecticut to learn about our freedom of information law, as they consider, what they might do in their own jurisdictions as it comes to public records.
That's amazing. Well, glad that you're on board to help shepherd the Connecticut Freedom of Information Act through its 50th year anniversary, and I trust you'll be here for many more of them. Russell Blair is the Director of Education and Communications for the Connecticut Freedom of Information Commission. You can learn about everything that this organization does and virtually everything about the act by just visiting their website, ct.gov/FOI, or just search Connecticut Freedom of Information Act and you will find it. Russell Blair, thank you so much for the time this morning and best of luck to all of your colleagues up at the Freedom of Information Commission as well. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate it. And if anybody needs to contact the commission, we've got a very easy to remember email address. It is FOI@ct.gov. If you send us an email, we'll try to help you out.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.